This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is November 21st, 2019, and this is episode 165.
I'm Strachan Lundebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, all the bills the NDP are trying to pass in the last week of the fall session, and we take a look at Trudeau's new cabinet. Hint, it looks a lot like the old cabinet. First, we have to thank those who helped make the show possible. We got two new patrons in the last week, so thank you both. We're up to 74 people contributing to the show every week. My goal is to say that number every week so it gets bigger and bigger. Christmas is coming up, you know, we got flights to pay for.
Give the gift of podcasting for the holidays.
Yeah. And we lose a couple patrons every month through credit cards expiring. So help us keep the show going, patreon.com/politicoast. Also, tell a couple friends about us. We look at our metrics on how many people download us. We're doing healthy, but we could use some growth. It would be nice to see more growth, especially now that the election's over. We had a good run there, or you had a good run there during the election. Editing support is provided by Cortado Productions, awesome friends of ours, and Politicoast is always in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. Let's kick it off with the legislative whirlwind. This fall session actually started very boring. The NDP had one bill still on the order paper. That was the civil forfeiture bill, I believe, one of those that they eventually got through. And for the first, I think it was 2 weeks, they introduced like one or two bills. And I was like,
very slow start.
Why are they even here? But they've got a bunch on the paper now that they need to pass in the next 4 days.
They could always extend the sitting. They don't have to pass it, but they're trying to.
Yeah. They all came in this latter half, and it kind of raises the question, are they just, like, bad at writing bills, and it just took them this long?
Alternatively, a bunch of their staffers were out helping on the federal campaigns.
And on vacation in the summer, probably. So let's just run through the bills that are sitting on the order paper. They'll probably all get passed based on the record of this government, which is to not really let anything die. There's the Climate Change Accountability Amendment Act, Bill 38. Familiar with this one?
We talked about it when it first got in, or did we?
No, this is the amendment. So the Climate Change Accountability Act has already been passed. That was Clean BC. That's good stuff. We like that. This is like a minor amendment that says there should be annual reporting or something like that.
They just forgot it the first time?
I think they missed like one extra level of reporting they want to do. So...
The government doesn't generate enough reports as it is.
And if you think that's not controversial enough, there's Bill 39, one of our favorite, or Shannon's favorites, the Miscellaneous Statutes Minor Corrections and Statute Revision Amendment Act. One of those, there's a bunch of typos in all of our existing bills. I haven't looked through this one to know which bills are being affected. I always dream there's going to be a government that like slips in a major change in one of these. It's like the Don't Look Here bill.
Well, that's what omnibus bills were for. But this is just like fits in the formatting, I guess. You know, you don't want an errant semicolon to introduce bugs into the laws.
Yeah. Courts look at those sometimes. Next up, Bill 40, the Interpretation Amendment Act. This is the poorly named but very exciting bill that could mean the end of daylight savings time.
Possibly. If the government so chooses to then exercise the options under this bill. Just doesn't that actually remove daylight savings time? Just changes how the government interprets time zones.
It just defines Pacific time.
Yes.
And then lets the government do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. It's a very small bill.
Yeah.
You were talking about this before the show.
Yeah. So in either ERSLAT or the Canby Report slat, there was actually a good conversation going on about this bill, whether or not the government can just decide what time zone it's in by itself. Like you wouldn't think just random provinces could just declare, oh, we're whatever time zone.
I mean, Newfoundland could put themselves half an hour out.
Yeah. But you think there'd be at least some, like, body, international body that you have to just get the time zone names approved by. But no, not at all. It's a free-for-all.
And somehow it works.
Yeah. even though there's like two PSTs, the other one being Philippine Standard Time, which interestingly is also 8 hours away from UTC. But
it's plus instead of minus. Yeah.
So yeah, turns out BC can just arbitrarily decide to call this time zone whatever it wants. And so can California and Oregon and Washington. So if we all move to the same time zone, we could in theory have like five different names for it. We won't.
It's unlikely.
Yes.
But
fun quirks in the way things work.
Sometimes anarchy works. Bill 41 is the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. This is the BC laws will be brought into alignment with the United Nations Declarations on Rights of the Indigenous People. And it also gives ministries, importantly, the ability to negotiate on a nation-to-nation basis with First Nations.
Yeah, that piece in particular is the main meat of it. The rest is more a declaration of intent more than any actual changes to the law.
And reporting to show how they're getting there. Always need to have those reports tabled. If you've ever been on a nonprofit board, it is reports after reports. So I don't hate it. Bill 42 is a new one this week. It's the Fuel Price Transparency Act. This is following some of the... We missed one of the new gas inquiry reports that came out a couple weeks ago.
It was actually last week?
Yeah, only it didn't really say anything. The gas companies were asked to explain the 13-cent gap between the prices we pay in Metrovan and like the prices they pay just south of the border or elsewhere, and they couldn't.
Well, the 13-cent unexplained gap.
Right.
The price may actually be larger than that, but the factors they haven't figured out yet that go into that 13 cents is what accounts for that gap.
I think they got it down to 10 cents.
Okay. Yeah, that was part of the... Yeah, they could bring it, the range of it down a bit, as well as the report says they got a bunch of different answers from different companies and weren't able to synthesize it into an actual reason.
So this act, the Fuel Price Transparency Act, will just basically compel the five major gas retailers in BC to tell British Columbians how much they're marking up.
Well, tell the government.
Tell the government, who then has the right to tell anyone they want. So that'll be interesting to go through. I saw one discussion thread, I think it was in Elm Tots on Facebook, just saying like, you know, I'm in favor of anything that forces companies to say more. And I just started joking in there about, let's have the bill to require companies tell us how many toilets they have, or bill to tell us how many red pens they lost on a Thursday.
This is the stuff that makes for very angry Fraser Institute reports.
This is the Red Tape Act.
Yeah, you obviously need some reporting, but you don't want to go overboard, which just becomes a burden on companies to fill out a bunch of needless reports. We should probably just mention Elm Tots is the Expo Line teens for, or Expo Line memes for TransLink-oriented teens, the Vancouver-specific transit meme group.
If you're not in Elm Tots and live in Vancouver, why are you listening to this podcast, really, though?
I expect there's a large overlap with our listeners, but we have gotten comments before about throwing out acronyms, so I just wanted to make sure that got notified. And it is a good group, so you should join it.
So the Fuel Price Transparency Act does, I think, target a real need of this, why are we getting gouged? And hopefully this can bring some light to it. It won't actually help fix high gas prices in BC. Luckily, those kind of magically fixed themselves after the government launched an inquiry and they dropped like 20 cents. And they've been not unreasonable. They're not cheap. Like it's $1.40, $1.30 right now for gas, which is better than the $1.70 it was when everyone was mad. But we don't have a long-term solution to gas prices.
No. Although something I did see this past week, which I don't think made it into our show notes here, is that BC is setting records for electric vehicle sales. So maybe high gas prices have their upsides.
That was my other solution, is just ban cars. And we don't need to tell us. Or ban, I guess, gas cars. And then we don't need to know how much they're gouging. Bill 43 is the Election Amendment Act. I don't know if we've touched on this one, but this is a modernization of the Elections Act that is well-deserved and very good, but I think was quickly misunderstood because it allows two things. One is for 16-year-olds to be able to register to vote. It doesn't give them the right to vote, and it allows the poll station workers to use technology like electronic vote counters and easier ways to get those ballots counted and get the count into central office so it can be disseminated. What people interpreted the announcements as was, oh, 16-year-olds can vote and you're doing online voting? Or electronic voting? No, there will still be paper ballots.
Which is good, because online voting has a whole bunch of problems with it.
Yep. And 16-year-olds will just be registered, so when they turn 18, they can vote. Now, registration isn't that hard. You can do it at the polling station in Canada. But it's still a good step forward, and, you know, it's like the minimum bar to trying to boost youth engagement.
Yeah, so I don't think BC you automatically register when you do your taxes, like, federally. So, yeah, not a bad thing.
Bill 44 doesn't exist yet.
Mystery bill.
Sometimes the government leaves gaps when they have a bill they're still working on, but they haven't been ready to bring forward, so...
Why not just move the other bill up?
Then they'd have to change all the print, all the fonts on all the paper. Because they probably actually have printed a bunch of copies, because I think every MLA gets a copy still. I wouldn't be surprised. We'll have to ask. If you know that, tweet at us. So the last bill on the order paper right now of the government bills is 45, the Taxation Statutes Amendment Act.
This one, I believe, is related to the vaping changes that were brought in that we discussed last week. In order to actually implement the 20% PST on vaping products that they announced, they actually need to amend the statute that gives them the power to tax stuff.
This should be like one of the least controversial ones. I think the Liberals have been calling for vaping regulations. The Greens might be against it, but probably
not. Well, no, because vaping wouldn't be the natural way of consuming nicotine.
The BC Greens aren't as granola as some of the other ones. But yeah, uncontroversial bill. Let us tax bad things at high rates. I'm fine with that. There's a whole bunch of private members' bills on the order paper, most of the ones that were introduced in the spring are still sitting there at first reading. A bunch of the ones that have been introduced since the fall are still sitting at first reading. I wanted to highlight the one that's passed this fall. That was Andrew Weaver's third bill that's been passed this year, which was the Ukrainian Famine and Genocide Holodomor Memorial Day Act, which recognizes the genocide of Ukrainian people by the Soviet Union. That was bad.
Yes, it was bad. And now we officially recognize that in BC.
The other two he had passed, I think we've talked about in the past, were a change to the Rental Tenancy Act and the B Corp's ability to create a company for companies that promote a better, healthier society. There are a couple other private members' bills that are still sitting on the order paper. This week, Spencer Chandra Herbert was specifically getting dragged on Twitter over the government's refusal to move forward the Greens' conversion therapy ban. On the government's arguments and NDP partisans, they argued it's a symbolic bill, we'll wait for the federal government to put it in the criminal code.
Do you need to wait for the federal government, though?
It's already banned in BC, according to them.
It's banned in BC in the sense that you can't bill for it under the healthcare system. But it's not banned in the sense of being actually prohibited from carrying out that.
And people have lived through it in BC. Peter Gadgets is on Twitter pointing this out repeatedly, like the doctor who quote-unquote treated him billed MSP. He just didn't call it conversion therapy.
Yeah, so, which in the NDP's defense would be against the rules. The thing is, if it was, say, paid for out of pocket or something, it wouldn't be.
Yeah, and the bill does ban it for minors, because it's harder to ban things adults do to one another, but until it goes in the criminal code, it's really hard to see the NDP's strength here, or even what they're gaining by not passing this. I was saying to someone in DMs, the NDP should want the gay vote. They have a lot of it, so why aren't they going to bat for it? Like, what's the loss?
Yeah, this was a little confusing in the sense that it's meaning they're taking needless political heat for it. Even bumping it up, like, just...
Let it go to committee. Yeah. If there are problems with the bill, they can suss it out there. Like, the bill, like, just, most
yeah,
of Weaver's...
Yeah, keeping it stuck on the order paper. Like, I get that they have a limited number of days in their session, but, yeah, just looking like you're blocking it entirely just seems to be the sort of thing that means the NDP is taking needless political heat.
Because, like, the other private members bill that I would love to see some movement on is one of the ones that the BC Liberals introduced, Stephanie Cadieux, specifically the Equal Pay Reporting Act, and this would require companies to disclose some amount of information about what their gender pay gap is. the idea being that will encourage companies to close the gap and make sure women and men get paid equally. Basic, reasonable stuff. The NDP can argue the Liberals didn't put any of their bills to the Legislative Drafting Service, which would give it some veracity, you know, make sure it's not causing needless consequences.
It's still amend in committee or something later on.
Definitely.
There's ways to solve that throughout the process where you don't necessarily have to have all your I's dotted and T's crossed at first reading.
Fully agree. I also think the Liberals are almost being petty by refusing to use this service because they, I guess, see it as, I don't know what the argument against it is. Like, it was created to support opposition members bringing forward bills that the government would then consider picking up. They've only picked up two or three in the time, but that's frankly two or three more than any government in BC history has really picked up for private members' bills.
Yeah, and it's from the Greens, so they have a much friendlier relationship with that. The Legislative Drafting Service thing may be one of those things where, you know, okay, if the Liberals start using it, well, then it'll just be some other excuse not to pass Liberal bills.
And that's basically where the legislature's at right now. Not overall a super ambitious fall sitting. The UNDRIP bill is good to see, although it was much shorter than I expected. I did actually expect them to start changing some laws instead of just committing to change laws, which they'd already done. Informally. I guess we'll have to see what they have in store for the spring. Maybe there'll be a new commitment in the throne speech. They're over halfway through their mandate at the end of this year.
I believe they have actually announced the calendar for the winter session.
For the 2020?
Yes. I actually have it in front of me.
But we'll be back in January. Well, I mean, we'll be continuing but we'll be back to talking about the BC legislature's
specifically when
business.
There's a new throne speech, when we're seeing the budget, all that. Yeah, we'll be looking forward to that. Moving on to segment two, cabinet shuffle. Yesterday, November 20th, Justin Trudeau finally unveiled his new cabinet. This came significantly later than his 2015 cabinet, but they finally figured out how they wanted to put one together, given the limitations they were facing.
Yeah, there's lots of ways we can tackle this. I mean, it's like 37 people. We're not going to talk about most of them.
And you could probably do it with a smaller cabinet.
It's the problem every government faces. So let's talk generally about cabinet building, which I think other podcasts have also done, Boys in Short Pants. But quickly, when you're building a cabinet, you want to use it as a way to reward MPs who've done well, who won a tough seat, things like that. Surprisingly, Adam Vancouverden didn't get in here, despite knocking off former cabinet minister Lisa Raitt.
Well, it's not the only thing that gets someone in cabinet.
Point being, but you also don't want to like kick someone out of cabinet if they're still doing fine and haven't gotten on your bad side, which creates this problem of your second cabinet's always going to be bigger than your first, and so on and so forth, until you finally just clear house and it's not personal. The thing the Liberals are always trying to avoid is the Chrétien Martin backstabbing era that went on for most of both of their prime ministerships. So I think this is a cabinet that will keep most of Trudeau's allies and friends happy.
It's an internal Liberal peace cabinet, like that squared away. Other challenge is, though, you generally want regional representation, and well, without any MPs in two provinces, that becomes a challenge for them.
Their solution was to appoint Jim Carr as the special representative for the Prairies. He's a Manitoba MP, but he's suffering cancer right now, so it wasn't clear if he was going to be staying in cabinet or fully put out and just left as a backbencher to try to recover. I guess he's in a weird middle zone because he's not officially a cabinet member, but he does represent all of the Prairies to cabinet. Beyond that, in terms of regional representation, you have four MPs from British Columbia in cabinet, basically all the ones who were there last time, except Jody Wilson-Raybould, who's not a Liberal anymore.
And hasn't been in cabinet for a while anyway. But with the exception of Harjit Sajjan, most of the BC cabinet got new roles. Carl Lequatro is now Minister for Employment, Workforce Development, and Disability Inclusion. Jonathan Wilkinson moved from Fisheries to Environment and Climate Change, interestingly taking that portfolio from Catherine McKenna, who I suspected was going to keep it just because the Liberals didn't want to look like they were going to bat down after, was it Kenny, Moe, one of the Prairie premiers demanded she be removed from the portfolio.
McKenna was instead given infrastructure and communities. So she might be partially responsible for building said pipeline that they're very upset about. It might still follow a little more under natural resources.
Something like that's going to go through multiple ministries. And finally, Joyce Murray, MP from Vancouver here, now Minister for Digital Government.
She moves there from Treasury Board, which I think most people thought was a weird fit for her, but I think she kind of got stuck there when it was like, well, she should get something, and it was near the end of the last parliament.
Is digital government a better fit?
No, it's a demotion. Oh, is it a better fit for her? No. But I guess it was the short straw. I put the order in our show notes. That is the precedence order. So it's the who's the most senior government official if all the others above you have died. And Joyce Murray is the least senior except for the new cabinet members.
Yeah, although she was one of the most recent people brought into cabinet.
So Justin Trudeau, Freeland, and Lawrence McAuley are actually the top three.
Which is weird because you wouldn't expect the associate minister of national defense, also veterans minister, to be senior to the minister of defense.
But aside from the weird order of precedence, not a lot of huge changes in portfolios. A couple people did move around.
Well, I think the one that everybody's been talking about has to be Chrystia Freeland, who made a somewhat odd move for a well-performing minister in what's generally seen as one of the top portfolios of foreign affairs over to Minister for Intergovernmental Affairs and also Deputy Prime Minister. Now, it's worth pointing out that Deputy Prime Minister isn't actually a thing in a Westminster system. It's more just an extra title that gets thrown on. You could literally name that person anything because it's not technically a title in the sense that most ministers have a ministry.
So I think the common wisdom or understanding of this move is Freeland did well with Trump and other world leaders that are kind of going all over the place. So let's give her the job of dealing with the premiers, frankly, because it's going to require
the internal
that
internal Canadian diplomat.
Yeah, it's going to require that same level of tact, smarts, you know, patience, and putting up with Doug Ford, Jason Kenney, Scott Moe, and then a bunch of reasonable people in the same room. Scott Moe's not the worst. Well, he kind of is going populist just because he has to. But
well, his first like post-election thing he said was basically Liberal government needs to wholly adopt the Conservative government's platform for the sake of national unity, which is not exactly a reasonable position.
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking of him and Kenny aren't exactly Doug Ford, but that's such a low bar.
Even Doug Ford softened relative to Kenny and some stuff.
He just got quiet through the election. We'll see where things go.
Oh, I think post-election.
So Freeland's job is to make peace and to try to keep this country moving. Not just together. I don't think the separatist movements are worth any more discussion, but just stop the bickering and maybe find some common ground. Like, it turns out most of the governments in Canada, except ours here in BC, want TMX built. Well, Quebec probably doesn't, but doesn't really affect them. They're more concerned about Energy East. So Freeland's move makes sense from that lens. And I guess if you think Trump is going to go down either from his own ill health, impeachment, or the 2020 election, she's not as necessary there. Instead, François-Philippe Champagne gets the honor of dealing with Trump.
Lucky him. And then I think rounding off the senior cabinet ministers, it's worth mentioning Bill Morneau staying in finance, as well as public safety now has Bill Blair running it, which has, I think, being one of the more controversial picks.
Bill Blair was the former chief of the Toronto Police during, I think it was the G20, when it visited there and there was a massive police crackdown on protesters. So a lot of the left holds him in special resentment as being one who would trample civil liberties and the right to, you know, assembly and protest. And so giving him something like public safety is a way of saying, he's not going to declare martial law in Canada, but it's got that
feeling.
It's more
of a tough on crime pick.
I think there are only so many cops in the Trudeau caucus.
You don't have to put a cop.
You don't have to, but they do it a lot. And so that's probably where they went. I don't know who else you'd put in there, frankly. I'm not saying I'm happy with him there, but if I was Trudeau, who would I pick? Maybe I just wouldn't have the ministry.
You kind of
emergency preparedness is an important ministry.
You do need public safety. CSIS reports through public safety. It's something you need. But yeah, moving on. David Lametti is staying on as Attorney General, so everyone will be watching whether or not he goes forward with the deferred prosecution agreement for SNC-Lavalin, which I think the Liberals might just be some combination of arrogant and stupid enough to do.
Carolyn Bennett also stays with Crown Indigenous Relations, which she's been a pretty well-performing, strongly performing minister, so that will probably be a tough file, especially if Trudeau wants to try to keep some promises on reconciliation that have been seemingly walked back.
But I think there's been one new minister in particular whose title has elicited a fair degree of mockery, so largely justified.
Mona Fortier, who's new to the cabinet, has the Associate Minister for Finance title, which is a real thing, and then the Ministry of Middle Class Prosperity.
Which I thought the Liberals had already kind of peaked on their cringeworthy pandering to the middle class with some of their early budget names. And what was it? The middle class and those looking to join it.
Those working hard to join
it. Working hard to join it, that line that got repeated ad nauseum. But they've wound up themselves.
Like, I can see having ministers for economic classes. I mean, the rich don't need a minister. They have finance. They have Bill Morneau in cabinet. They don't need their own minister. But like, do the working class not need a minister then too? Do the unemployed not need a minister? I mean, there's a jobs minister, but
the labor minister, I think.
Labor minister. So, yeah. No, I'm going to be interested to see what that mandate letter says. Define the middle class in such a way that everyone fits in it.
That's pretty much already what happens.
So in the growth of this ministry, what we did see were a couple people not get returned to cabinet. That's Kirsty Duncan and Jeanette Petipas Taylor. I try. Duncan gets to be the deputy house leader, though, and Taylor the deputy whip. So both important roles that mean they're still around, but not necessarily handling a whole ministry. The one thing that stood out to me, though, as well, is the Ministry of Democratic Institutions has disappeared. This was before Trudeau's time, the Ministry of Democratic Reform. And briefly, I think when Belinda Stronach was crossed the floor, the Ministry of Democratic Renewal. It gets a lot of names, but its ambition was always good of let's look at how our elections work and figure out if there's ways to improve them. In the lead up to the election, this involved things like, hey, what are the electronic risks we could be facing? And they drew a lot of criticism for that, especially because they talked a lot about things that didn't turn out to happen. But maybe that's because we were prepared for them, especially since in 2015, Trudeau ran on electoral reform. And now we don't even have a ministry dedicated to like basic democratic improvement. It's not a great sign. It's not even clear who's going to be responsible for reviewing. Like, it should just be a normal process to review how well the election went and decide if it needs improvement. I guess that's just on Elections Canada, which takes it out of the hands of the politicians.
Yeah, or it's trying to get tucked in some, I don't even know which ministry you tuck it into.
Middle class prosperity. So yeah, it's a largely status quo ministry. There's not a huge turnover. I saw some analysis from Eric Grenier at CBC suggesting it's very tilted towards Toronto and Montreal-based MPs. I mean, the Liberals have a lot of seats in those two cities, so it's not super surprising, but I think it's
In central Canada, outside of those two areas, yeah, you don't find a lot of Liberal MPs. Somewhere around Ottawa, but you know, they're represented as well.
Yeah, I guess we'll just be watching to see if anyone stands out from this ministry, if anyone's able to rise in the ranks and gain some extra prominence, or if it'll just be kind of a attempt to keep the Liberal ship going in the direction it's been going, like they promised to in the election, which seems like what they're trying to do here. There's no Minister of Pharmacare. Not that that would be a thing, but that would be a very clear sign that they're reaching for Jagmeet Singh's hand.
Yeah, I don't think they'd be that upfront about it.
Oh, and Heather McPherson, the NDP MLA from Edmonton Strathcona, was not appointed to cabinet, even though she had briefly said, well, if they ask, I wouldn't necessarily say no. And then people were like, what a sellout. And it's like...
That's like a very Elizabeth May thing to say, actually.
Yeah. Elizabeth May, also not in cabinet. A little surprising.
So not yet speaker either.
They haven't voted yet.
Yeah.
They haven't had their first session. That's on December 5th, I believe. But yeah. Well, I guess see on December 5th who becomes speaker and how the House shapes up. But otherwise, I guess we can wait to see who the opposition's parties appoint as their critics. I can't wait to see the NDP's critic for middle-class prosperity.
I was just going to make that joke myself. Beat me to it.
All right. Let's move on to quick takes. Last week, we spent quite a bit of time talking about the Senate.
I feel like we need just a regular return segment, something like Red Alert or something basic, you know, red, it's the Red Chamber. But yeah, just a recurring Senate, you know, who has a caucus this week and who doesn't, because it has changed yet again.
So the answer is the Progressive Senate group that we spent some time talking about no longer exists because they lost a member. Senator Percy Down has left the Progressive Senate group and joined the Canadian Senate group, the CSG, because he said he felt more at home there. And that meant his 8 Liberal friends who are now Progressive Senators.
Who were Progressive Senators and no longer.
I mean, they still identify as Progressive Senators.
Yes, but if you go on the Senate website, they're just listed as independents now.
Unaffiliated.
Unaffiliated,
because there's
right.
too many independents. It right. makes it confusing. They're hoping to find one more senator to cross to join their little party. As well, Senator Jean-Guy Dagenais left the Conservative caucus for the Canada Senate group. This one's especially interesting because he cited Scheer's leadership and performance in the federal election as his reasons for quitting the party, and specifically talked about how Scheer seemed too socially conservative for his values, and he didn't identify with that anymore. So he's going to join the small C Senate group. Or I guess it's a big C, but it stands for Canadian. So yeah, more drama in the Senate. That's our senseg.
Well, moving into another house where there was a lot of drama, this time in the Alberta legislature, as an MLA by the name of Rachel Notley was kicked out of the house.
I've heard of her. She's a little bit of a rabble-rouser, I take it. Weird stuff's happening in Alberta. So Jason Kenney announces that they're going to bring in forward this bill to merge...
Was it part of the budget implementation?
No, I think it was a standalone bill. But it was going to...
Because they announced in the budget, I think.
They're going to merge and consolidate the Office of the Election Commissioner into the Office of the Chief Electoral Officer. That sounds really boring and like it doesn't matter and almost kind of makes sense. Except the result of doing this is to fire the elections commissioner, the guy who's investigating the United Conservative Party leadership race for violations of the Elections Act, among other things, which is how Kennedy became leader and eventually premier. There was a bunch of scandals involving kamikaze candidates who were like brought on by Kenny possibly to like just make other people look bad so Kenny didn't have to get his hands dirty, and allegations like that. All fun, good, old-fashioned Alberta stuff. And this investigation was happening, and so they introduced a bill to basically fire the guy, you know, Comey style. And not only that, but they announced before the bill was even introduced and MLAs could look at it, that they were going to invoke cloture at every stage as soon as it came in to rush it through in a day. Because, you know...
That's not sketchy at all.
You gotta fire this guy fast. So that set off some protests.
Which is understandable.
And Rachel Notley decided to try to use every tool she had. She wrote to the lieutenant governor saying, you have to stop this bill, which is not something they can do.
Also, a former premier should know that.
I think she was just reaching for straws. I think she wrote a couple other people to be like, please stop this bill. In the House, what led to her being ejected was saying that the House leader from the Conservatives was misleading the House And the premier is saying Albertans are subject to one set of rules, but when it comes to himself, it's a whole new world and he can rewrite them to cover up demands. She basically said the House leader and the premier were liars, which is unparliamentary language and gets you kicked out. So she got expelled, which in a way is actually a major victory for her because it gets more attention on it. It's not every day the leader of the opposition is kicked out of the House. I mean, it happens more than you would expect in Canada. Pretty sure Dave Barrett did it like twice after he lost his premiership. And the opposition in Canada, opposition parties in Canada do not have much power. So being able to throw up a big storm does help a little bit.
Yeah, especially something like this where there should be a lot of attention paid to it. And yeah, there's a disconcerting trend that's not just in Canada or Alberta about politicians starting to take advantage of the powers they have, but have been, where it's generally been seen to be outside of the bounds of properness to exercise those powers to shift how the elections are run. And for the most part, Canada's avoided it, but this is a worrying sign.
Yeah, there have been some scandals in Ontario with Doug Ford and norm breaking there. The other thing happening in Alberta, where there's about to be some greater tension, is it sounds like Kenny might fire the Calgary Board of Education. Basically, I know some teachers in Calgary, and because of the latest budget, there wasn't a direct cut to education, but there was basically a freeze and a promise for no additional money to cover all the additional students that come in every year. So it's an effective cut. And the Calgary Board of Education, already being cash strapped as it was, said, we need to slap on additional fees to all parents in the middle of the year for books and field trips and things. Those not mandatory fees, but if you don't pay them, we're going to judge your kids and maybe hold it against you. And then they also announced they are laying off 300 temporary teachers. That looks bad when you're a provincial government who ran on a promise to do cuts that don't affect frontline workers. So now the Kenny government is trying to put talking heads out there to say this is an incompetent board that can't handle its budget and maybe they should just be replaced. Funnily enough, like half of this board was our conservative affiliated politicians, like people who ran on like Kenny endorsed slates. Like Calgary and Alberta doesn't have local political parties like we do here in BC. But imagine it's like the NPA social conservatives are on the Calgary Board of Education fighting with the United Conservative Party. I kind of wish the Calgary board would just have like pulled a Vancouver board and been like, we won't run a deficit, or we'll run a deficit, we won't do these cuts. Maybe they didn't have that authority. I'm curious to see where this goes. I feel bad because I have, like I said, friends and family who work as teachers in Alberta. I keep telling them, like, BC is looking for teachers. I know that's not ideal, but I mean, our teachers might be on strike soon, but
we don't have enough of those going on in BC at the moment.
They all happened at once, hey?
Yeah.
We went from, like, labor peace for such a while to suddenly, like, there's a small-scale teacher strike on the island that I think just wrapped up. Multiple transit strikes happening in Metro Van now, or potentially
one. One strike and like one vote to authorize the strike.
And then lumber mill actions, and there's a lot going on. It's hard to keep up.
Yeah.
So that's Alberta. Things are tense there. But moving to the international stage, something interesting happened at the United Nations this week, where Canada effectively flip-flopped the position we've had since 2003. So Canada's been pretty consistent, especially under Harper, but it started under Martin, actually, of voting with Israel when motions about Israel-Palestine come up. Most of the world votes, you know, to recognize Palestine and things like that. And Canada tends to join the U.S. and Israel saying...
How about your European countries, too?
Not many. Some of these motions only get, like, Canada, the U.S., and, like, two island nations that depend on the U.S. And Canada will be like, yeah, we're with that. There are some others that are a bit more nuanced. I think this specific one, it was, like, the U.S. and Israel were the only two countries who really voted against it.
Yeah, and so Israel, the U.S., and three Pacific island nations.
Yeah, who wouldn't exist as independent nations without the U.S.
Yeah, so, yeah, Marshall Islands, Nauru, and the Federated States of Micronesia.
And so it's interesting because Canada didn't just go from voting no to abstaining and then voting yes, but just like flip-flopped. And now people are kind of wondering what motivated that, and will this be a bigger shift in Canada's voting on, you know, Middle Eastern issues at the UN?
I think there's a Security Council seat coming up.
And one we've been hoping for since Stephen Harper shunned it.
Well, no, the Liberals lost out of one earlier in their last mandate. But there was questions on whether or not positions related to Israel had a factor in that.
But Israel's also, I wasn't going to bring this story up other than the fact we were talking about Israel, is that just, I think it was today, it was announced Netanyahu's being charged with corruption, specifically a few counts of fraud, a few counts of breach of trust, and even bribery relating to just like all the messiness that he allegedly has gotten up to. He is calling it an attempted coup because those are in vogue right now. But yeah, Israel's in a tough state. They've had two elections this year so far, in April and September, neither of which resulted in a working majority for anyone. So they may be going back to the polls. Netanyahu, since he hasn't been convicted and expended all his appeals, will be probably allowed to run. Whether or not that's a good idea.
Yeah, if I recall, Israel, uses a pure proportional system.
Yeah.
So
the one no one advocates for because of that mess.
Yeah. Although it works fairly well in the Netherlands, which also runs a pure proportional system. So I think it depends a lot on the broader political culture too.
I think there's some eccentricities of Israeli domestic politics.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to get to, is that, you know, I think Netanyahu's base is fairly locked in, so.
And then he can usually count on a couple more conservative religious groups to go along with him. But they've not been as strong lately. And then I think he's also proven or been around so long that enough corruption has built up and baggage has built up that there's a breakaway center-right bloc that was actually doing well. But again, still not well enough to take him down. So they're deadlocked. Keep your eye on Israel for the next year, because it's not going to like devolve or anything, but it will be interesting to see if, you know, Bibi's power has finally come to an end, which I think would be good for the world.
And finally, you wanted to talk about this petition that went nowhere, not even like the barely anywhere you'd expect of a low result petition, but like basically not didn't even happen.
So,
for all the signatures they got.
Hopefully listeners are familiar with BC's Citizen Petition Initiative Act, the thing that basically gives us as citizens the ability to get together, get a whole bunch of signatures together, and force a bill or a change to the law. It's a direct democracy thing brought in, I think, by Gordon Campbell, but maybe even by Mike Harcourt. Like, it's been around a while now. There's only been one successful initiative that forced a referendum, and that was the HST, most famously. A couple others, one I think recall came close, but this one that was just announced in the spring that some random guy in Comox was going after, he wanted to get charter schools in BC, and he wanted to have a pilot project where BC would fund 20 charter schools, American-style charter schools, or Alberta-style ones. So board of local volunteers, not religious actually, it said in there, could get together and say, we're creating a charter school and the government just has to pay that. You need 10% of the voters, of the registered voters in every constituency in BC to sign your petition.
So how much did they get of that?
Well, I did have to look up. So there's 3.25 million registered voters. I think that was as of 2017. So, you know, 300,000 signatures you needed. They got 8. They weren't verified because Elections BC wasn't going to waste their time verifying. And obviously, I did ask Elections BC how many they got. And they said, yeah, we don't verify if it's not, it's clear it's not going to pass. But yeah, 8.
It's not even like friends and family level of signature collection.
And I think they had 90 days, like 3 months to collect signatures. They got 8.
Because I think they had, I also saw something where they had, like 8 campaigners. So basically like everyone's.
I think, so they had 8 canvassers, which I think may have been just another word for signatures.
Right.
But yeah, like, when I saw the advisory that this initiative was launching and we were going to collect signatures, I had to go, because you can register as an opposition party to it. Like, you are going to campaign against this petition. I was like, oh, is that worth campaigning against? You know, I'm a very strong public school advocate. I support this, you know, one public system, and we shouldn't throw money at voucher type systems. But then I kind of like looked into the guy, and he'd like run for city council, and he'd gotten more than 8 votes at, I think it was Comox City Council in the previous election, but it was like not a strong showing. So yeah, I was like, this probably isn't going to go anywhere. And then I was surprised how bad it did, because yeah, I could get 8 signatures by the time we get out of this building.
For something crazier than this too.
Probably.
Yeah.
So that was my amusing story of the week. And I think that's where we can end it today.
Okay. And that has been Politjoes. Find links to everything we talked about at politjoes.ca. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politjoes. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Sergio Plotnikoff. Editing services are provided by Cortado Productions. Thanks for listening.